saving money on your next painting project with Menards. Get a paint that combines gorgeous color and durability. Dutch Boys Platinum Plus is a paint and primer with a protective finish that guards against scuffs, spills, and stains. Get $15 off instantly on a single qualifying purchase of $100 or more on Dutch Boy and Purdy products. Now through March 8th. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Dre. And welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda, and we are back to talk about the news that you might not have heard around equity, race, and justice, or the news that you did hear and with a different lens. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Posse of the People. Here we go. Nothing says welcome home like a daily reminder of Trump's dirtiest little secret, and boy, do we have the doorstep accessory for you. Release the Epstein files. Doormats are available for pre-order now at the grocery store. You can make sure no one steps foot in your home without a reminder of the thing Trump wants us to forget. Shop now at crooked.com/store. Well, we were on break for Labor Day, and we are back, and it seems like a lifetime worth of news has happened in between. But here we are. I'm Deray, at DRAY on Twitter.
I'm Miles E. Johnson, at Feral Rapture on Instagram.
And I'm Sharonda Bossier. You can find me on LinkedIn or on Instagram at Bossier Shay, or on Spill at Bossier S.
I need to log back into Spill. I was like an OG spiller and then just fell off. There's a lot going on. Let's start with rest in peace to Roland Ray. When I saw that online, I was like, this is not real, because you never know what's real anymore online. And then it was like, oh, this is real. And Roland Ray was such a key. But Miles, lead us into our tribute to Roland Ray.
So, A, I love language. I love Black people who break language and use language in ways that are a big irreverent FU to the people who construct it. And Roland Ray is one of those people. Even if you don't know exactly who Roland Ray is, you probably heard somebody say purr. One of the more iconic moments for me is when he was next to another reality star named Bobby Lights, and they're in this battle, and Roland Ray pretends to die, and he comes back, and he looks at Bobby Light and says, I just came back from the dead, and you're still not that girl. And it's so
it was brilliant.
And it's so funny. And outside of what he contributed to language, I also love where people who we would not have seen at all get to be seen. And I think part of what makes his death really sad is because this is still somebody who was battling inside of poverty, battling inside of disability. So even though we saw him, even though he had fame, and even though he probably had moments in his life that he wouldn't be able to have if it were not for the internet, he was still somebody who succumbed to what looks like the data and the trends have been showing, that millennials are going to be dying earlier. There's going to be moments where people are passing away earlier. And I think that I'm just kind of filled with appreciation that somebody who was so disadvantaged in society still had a moment in the sun being themselves and being as non-respectable and as irreverent and as absurd as Roland Ray got to be. So it feels it feels wrong to try to be any more serious than that when talking about Roland Ray, even in death.
I rarely find people who are online like laugh out loud funny, but I always found Roland Ray laugh out loud funny. And also someone I was very clear I never wanted to attempt to match wits with. You know what I'm saying? I was like, I never want to be on the receiving end of any of that. You got it, girl. So yeah, rest in peace to a real one.
And I think about Roland Ray as a disability rights activist. In 2020, Roland Ray was outside in the protests like anybody else, like fighting on the front line. And that was important to see. And like you said, Miles, what does it mean to make sure that we represent all people's experiences? And Roland Ray was hilarious. And, you know, Cardi had a good tribute to Roland Ray yesterday. A lot of people had tributes to Roland Ray, but died
did Beyonce.
So young. Beyonce was his friend. Remember when Beyonce wrote that thing to him?
That was in my mind as like a second connection because he died around Beyonce's birthday and he lied on divorce court and said that him and Beyonce were friends and she checks up on him. And then Beyonce, fast forward, actually sends him an Ivy Park package and checks up on him. So kind of legitimizing this kind of like viral moment and the fact that he actually passed away around Beyonce's birthday. I think he passed away on the 3rd and her birthday's the 4th. You know, one of those kismet kisses.
Rest in play, Roland Ray. Now, did y'all also see Cardi B's trial? And if you did not, I hope that you will go back and look at some of the clips. But Cardi B was in a court. It was a civil case for damages because there was a security guard who said that Cardi B hit her. That is the short version of it. There are no cameras. There were no cameras. So Cardi B was on the stand and she was hilarious. And then they used those images of her on trial as a part of her album rollout, which I also thought was so this moment and so Cardi B. But did y'all see that?
I did. I also saw all the looks as she was like going into court every day because people wanted to do that. Cardi B is also somebody I never want to match wits with, right? You know what I mean? Like, I never want to be on the receiving end of anything from her. I saw some of the clips. I thought they were pretty funny. The other thing is, you know, people were like, is this fatphobic? Is it not? Especially because she's come under fire recently for having said some fatphobic things and for some of her fat fans feeling like she's directed ire at them. But when people were joking about like her saying that the woman was like security guard big, as y'all know, I've been like in a gym where lots of women are like lifting weights and security guard big became actually like a rallying cry because we were doing benchmarks and it was like, well, how heavy can you squat? You know? Lots of material, let's say, coming out of that Cardi B trial.
Yeah, I definitely saw the Cardi B clips. I think I was less interested in, I think because the fat conversation was so exhausted, you know, and I'm not at the point in my feminism that like, so when things are happening in culture that are like fascist, it's hard for me to go to the physical or the vanity, even if it's still like substantive and real and there's real ways you can pull from it. It's hard to go there in those conversations. So I think that's the reason why even the conversation around Cardi B and fat phobia and stuff like that kind of simmered out in a way that maybe 2 years ago it wouldn't have. What I was really interested in is, I don't know if you all remember Cardi B's press video, and she actually
press, that song?
Yeah, so she actually pretended to be coming from a court house, and she makes inside this video this kind of, through visuals, this statement around, you know, using power and sex appeal in order to navigate the court systems and navigate publicity. And it's interesting to see her actually apply that because at the end of the day, we saw Cardi B throw the shoe at Nicki Minaj. We know that she has a violent past. And I'm not somebody who's anti-violence, so I'm not really necessarily critiquing her use of violence if she felt it was needed. But I am... It is interesting to me that she's able to be meta about how she's going to use her glamour, her celebrity in order to navigate power and her actually do that, be so funny, be so charming, have the outfits to make sure that she still maintains her power. And it's just interesting because, you know, in America, we'll always kind of side with power if it's seductive enough. And I think Cardi B joins the likes of Johnny Depp, Gwyneth Paltrow, if I'm being very extreme, even OJ, this use of your celebrity in order, Michael Jackson, this use of your celebrity in order to escape probably something that you did. And it's interesting to see people kind of side with power yet again, because it's sexy and glamorous.
Did you see that, you know, she wore different wigs every day? And the lawyer from opposing counsel's like, you know, how do you change your hair that quickly? And she's like, it's a wig. And there were these moments, like she knew the camera was on too. And there's like that celebrity part of it that works. And to put your album roll out when you know you're going to be in court and like, you know, you'll just be on TV every day or
in
like
the
it'll
headlines,
be.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'll be in the headlines. It was like, that was a smart move. The other person that was getting people in a tizzy was Miles's favorite homegirl on YouTube. The
AKA
other Taylor.
Woke Katy Perry.
Not Taylor Swift, but Taylor Lorenz. Miles, I'll turn it over to you because she is your homegirl and she had people worked up.
It's funny because she's not my favorite, but she's the YouTuber who most intersects with what I do on this podcast. so she's been a Cliff Jane notes for me. And I'm like, thank you, Taylor, for telling me why I don't feel like deep diving every single week. But there was this Wired article that came out and it exposes this dark money nonprofit that has basically been channeling money to different Democratic influencers and a lot of the political TikTok influencers that we've been seeing, Instagram influencer we've been seeing, and the YouTube influencer that we've been seeing have shown to be taking money from these dark money organizations. And she kind of busts it open and names people. And some of those people are people that a lot of people love. The one person who I was a light consumer of who was in it was Conscious Lee. I was deeply disappointed. Everybody else I only knew about, but I was not surprised because I've said on this very podcast how strange some of the communications have been coming from the left online. You can see who is in cahoots with a corporation and who's not by how they speak, what they won't speak about, and how rabid they are for a political candidate instead of maybe an actual perspective. You know, I'm rabid, but I'm rabid about Black feminism, Afro-pessimism, blah, 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 blah. Being rabid around a person maybe implies that I might be getting paid by them. And yeah, there has been so many YouTube videos about that article. I know that everybody's not like plugged into what's been going on YouTube, but so many people have been making, having talks about YouTube. There's been so many TikToks about it. And then also the responses to the article by the influencers. Some of them are saying the same language. And like, the idea is that there was a press release sent to these influencers. It told how to respond, and like these influencers are copying and pasting those press releases and maybe judging them, but the core language is the same, which is letting you know this is maybe not the most convincing way to prove that you're not being puppeted by the Democratic Party. And that's the news story.
Can you say more about the disappointment you felt in finding out that someone you even lightly listened to was being compensated for producing content aligned with one perspective or one set of priorities? I'm very curious about that, given how much I feel like you have said, at least on this podcast, right, that you try to connect to ideas and not to people.
Yeah, it's the transparency. I think that's the disappointment that I feel, because specifically if you're Black, right, there's just been a long legacy of Black people who sold us out, you know, even when we think about the Black church and the Black church being annihilated. Part of the annihilation of the Black church had to do with the Black church portraying Black people politically for political gain. So if you're Conscious Lee and you're showing me you with a Black trans woman, if you're telling me these things that are supposed to be pro-Black, I'm taking that you're telling this from your soul. And if you really have an opinion about Israel that is different from mine, at least I know that this has been generated from the core of you and from your mind and not because of dollars. And that's where the disappointment comes in. Because I do think specifically for Black people, there has to be some type of establishment of like community and trust, even digitally, in order for a digital community to work. And at least saying, you know what, I got paid $500 to not say something. Well, let me know that I can at least trust you. And that's where it comes from.
You know, one of the big responses to in defense of those creators was people got to get paid. That many of them said that the course, which was the group paying them, was not their only funder. And if we are going to stand up to the billionaire-funded ecosystem that the right wing has with the radio stations, the podcasts, da-da-da, then the left should have a response to that, and that this seems to have been a response. So we shouldn't be as critical of them as people have been because of that. Like, what is the alternative? Is there supposed to be no ecosystem of creators on the left? What do you say to that? I saw that as well.
What I have to say to it first and foremost is that makes me sad. If you're inside the field of talking about what's right for Black people to make money, then you're in the wrong field. If you have to make certain types of financial sacrifices, if this is a mode for you to find financial stability, if this is a mode for you to find financial freedom, and it's on Black people, and it's on expressing certain types of rhetoric to different Black people, and you are feeling and you're compromised by money, then you're in the wrong field. Lane, you should not be in this to get rich, and you should also be extremely transparent about where you are getting money. So it's, again, not just about getting the money, it's also about the non-transparency about getting the money. And then the last thing that I'll say that it's about too is that it's not the left. Which is another thing I try to say on this podcast. If you can't talk about AIPAC, if you can't critique Israel, if you are being told what not to say, if you're being told what candidate to say, that is a conservative fascist thing that is happening on the left, but it's not the left. So you're still not creating an actual ecosystem for the people on the left, because there's still people further left than you who are not let in. So you are just now solidifying yourself inside of the right, but a more liberal right, but still the right itself. So yeah, how do y'all feel?
I thought it was interesting. I actually Taylor is a legitimate journalist, so I was surprised at the people attacking Taylor as like a journalist. I thought that was like a weird line of attack that did not hold. You don't have to like her journalism, but she is a journalist and she is a legitimate one. I think the most damning thing was their responses. The responses from the people was so defensive, but not about the things she was saying. And you're like, it was the, you got to pay me. And you're like, oh, that's real. She's not saying you should not be paid. She's saying it was secret and it came with these strings that your listeners did not know. And, it was just, so like the response videos were just like, this is a little, I don't know. That was weird. So I thought that was weird. I will give Taylor credit though, because if Taylor will draw a rock and show her hands and stand there and say, I got another rock. This is the rock. Rock, 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 rock. Like, Taylor is no punk.
Let me see your 23andMe, Taylor. I'm feeling a good 2% over there.
I don't know Taylor personally, but I don't see her sweat about it. I see her get annoyed when people like attack or something like that. But, I'm like, Taylor will draw a rock and show her hands. And that is, I respect that about her.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, I started going to therapy probably in 2020, like for real. I went as a kid a little bit, but like for real in 2020. And one of the things that was super powerful about it was that I needed somebody not in my everyday life to process the world with. And I'll tell you, I'm so proud of the things I've been able to do. And I'm like, I did this and I did this solo and I did this in a team. Da-da. And I got seduced by this idea that like I could figure it out. It's like a badge of honor. And one of the beautiful things about therapy is that like I can figure it out with help. Like I don't have to figure everything out alone. Like I'm not a superhuman special guy because I can just like power through. The power through was like a coping strategy. I actually needed somebody to talk to. I needed to say the things out loud. I needed to get feedback. Even if the feedback I disagree with, I needed to hear somebody else's perspective. And that's why I'm here to talk about BetterHelp. They've been around for over 10 years, have a 4.9 rating out of 1.7 million client session reviews, and they're fully online. You can pause your subscription wherever you need to and switch therapists at no extra cost. Over 30,000 therapists. And BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people globally. And it's convenient. You can join a session with a therapist with the click of a button, which helps you fit therapy into your busy life, and you can switch therapists at any time. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. Find the one with BetterHelp. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/people. That's better, BETTERHELP.com/people.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolet Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life. And it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a 5-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
Sharonda, I wanted to talk to you. I don't know if you saw that gel nail polish seems to be getting banned in parts of Europe for the toxins that might mess up women's fertility. Not yet banned in the UK and not yet banned here in the United States, but it seems like in both, they are on the list. And I wanted to know if this is making you change your habits around nail polish.
For those of you who do not know me, I have a standing biweekly nail appointment. I get my nails done. They are gel. I'm not changing anything, I don't think. I do think I'm going to look for, you know, brands that don't have, you know, the TPO. So they're supposed to be like this non-toxic alternative, and we'll see if they stick. But, you know, my nails have been part of who I am since I was 14. And I feel like there's a whole bunch of other stuff that I do that is potentially ill-advised, but my nails feel like part of me. Like having a manicure feels like who I am. When people who don't see me in person all the time run into me, they're like, let me see your nails, you know? So I did see the article. I've ignored everyone who has sent it to me, though I'm so grateful that so many of you love me. and I don't see myself changing my behavior. I just don't.
Doesn't it feel like sometimes people send you stuff and it's like, are y'all really sending me stuff to be inform me? Or are you trying to play like, what's going to be the knock that cracks the egg? Because I'm like, y'all know what's going on in the world. That's the last thing I need to see.
You were the first person I thought of, Sharon. I was like, oh, Sharon, they taking the gel, baby. They taking the gel out of here.
Oh, yeah. But I think to Miles's point, you know, especially with like gel manicures, for a while, there were concerns around the UV lights and it's all sorts of things, right? And I was like, look, I won't eat red dye, whatever, but I'm going to get my nails done and they will last the 2 weeks. So gel manicure is all the way.
Your gel manicure is on my Diet Coke.
Ooh.
It's like it's like because I have been living such a like sober life, and not that like, I mean just like no alcohol, no anything.
Yeah.
So Diet Coke is the thing, and I'm like, yeah. And people say this is in it, this is in it. I'm like, I don't care. We have to come on.
Do you actually like Diet Coke more than regular Coke?
Yes.
I like never got into Diet Coke.
It's a different taste, and then my mother. Growing up, she would always use Splenda. So I think that like even my taste, there's something familiar about okay. The sugar substitute that reminds me of that. Yeah.
That's interesting.
I'm a Coke classic girl.
But I'm also, you know, losing fitness diet, getting older. So I'm like, okay, zero calories.
It's when I posted a gym picture today and somebody was really shady and was like, they were like, what a weird rebrand. And I'm like, I don't know if this is a rebrand, but shout out to the gym pictures.
What you like, did you have clothes on?
Yeah, I mean, it was like the same gym photo that I post every single. It was okay. Like a rebrand from the vest.
Okay. I was just trying to contextualize the photo okay. Where I'm like, what would consider it a rebrand? Like,
it was like, I don't know, I rebranded as much as I just go to the gym now to stave off walking into traffic.
But also shout out to being a full person online and not like one dimensional, you know, like you have things you do outside of activism. Imagine that.
I think also the internet and social media in general is such a marketplace. So you showing something like that, even like I showed you all, we'll get into it when it's my news, but I showed you all my cooking. I'm very slow to show my cooking because then it turns into like a thing. And I'm like, no, I'm just, this is something I enjoy. So.
For those of you listening, I have already requested a plate. So I,
oh, yeah.
Those of us who are always hungry, I got us covered.
Now, if you eat the pork, because I still make it with the pork shoulder and stuff.
Oh, 100%.
Like that.
That's the only way to do
black.
It.
It's so
okay.
Black. I love it. No, he said, no turkey over here.
No,
not at all.
This is not my news, but I did want to talk about Miami. I don't know if you saw, but we talked about this, I think, a while ago. Miami had tried to changed the elections to coincide with the national elections, which would have allowed everybody in Miami local politics to stay in power for another year. And that was shady. And somebody running against one of them took it to court and recently lost. So they will have an election in November. And I hope they get all them people out of office. I hope they clean house in Miami because they were being really shady trying to move the election by a year against. Like, no referendum about it. No, they weren't going to let people vote. It was straight up the council did it. And I'm happy that they lost. Especially because that court of appeals over there is not always great. But they were, like, clear about this.
And Florida has proven to be a testing ground for so much that, you know, Republicans try and scale across the country. So was also glad to see this outcome.
Yeah, I feel like you can't even have excitement, like, for real. But I am excited to see in November what the real climate is, you know? And I think that waiting too long, and if that were to go through, so many things would have cooled off. But also, I think sometimes when we look at liberal blue MAGA media, well, like, you can't really tell if something's really taking foot somewhere. So I feel like this election will show, oh, is there actually a shift happening? Are people as upset as we're seeing on media? I think the elections will be a good time to see what's actually working when it comes to our media and what is just smoke and mirrors.
Well, I'll start. I don't know if you saw, since we're talking about Florida, we'll stay in Florida. Florida is proposing to remove all vaccine mandates, including all school vaccine mandates, and it is happening, or it seems to be happening. You might not know, but all 50 states adopted mandates in 1980, and as you can imagine, all of us had to get our shots before we went to school, and that was an important thing. And as of September 3rd, the state leaders, including the governor and the surgeon general, have said that they are going to try and do it. Now, obviously, parents are going to sue, you know, so this will be caught up for a while. You might be wondering, what are the required vaccines for school children in Florida? They have to get immunized against polio, diphtheria, rubella, rubiola, which you know as measles, pertussis, which you know as whooping cough, mumps, and tetanus. And private schools can set their own vaccine requirements, but public schools cannot. And I just never thought we'd live in a world where, like, we would just let that be up to families to decide. And it's like, more kids will die of whooping cough, which I didn't even know whooping cough was still around. Like, people still get whooping cough. I didn't even know that was, like, a thing, you know? I'm like, kids with their very weak immune systems. Anybody who's worked in a school, you know that you get sick the moment them kids come back anyway, just because, like, you know, school sickness. So I just want to bring it here because what's happening in this political climate is just contrary to all of the things that we have learned with regard to science and healthcare and da-da-da. And as much as RFK Jr. is anti-vaccination, all of his children are vaccinized. As much as Trump and them are, like, anti-da-da-da, they got the COVID vaccine. You're like, these people are playing y'all. And you know who's going to get vaccinized? The rich child of everybody in the state of Florida is getting a measles, mumps, and rubella. They are. It's just going to happen. They're not going to die like this. It's going to be poor people who are going to be like, oh, you know, I, like, didn't da 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 da. And so I hope that they take them to court. I hope that they do not allow them to do this. But I wanted to bring it here because it makes me nervous that other states might even try to do this. Like, I'm like, what is going on? So, yes.
Well, I live in the great state of California, and our governor has joined forces with the governors of Washington State and Oregon to form an alliance to issue their own guidance around required vaccines and required vaccine schedules, because they say we can no longer trust the feds to do it. Also, it's an attempt at ensuring that, you know, once the CDC changes guidance, what you can get access to in a clinic also changes, right? And I think we've talked about some version of this, particularly around like HIV and antiretroviral drugs. But anyway, it's been interesting to see California, Oregon, and Washington State try and like be a counterweight to some of this, as you know, and to form a bloc. You know, I also am terrified. You know, if you listen to the Surgeon General's remarks when he talked about this, you know, he likened vaccine requirements to slavery, which is a wild thing to hear come out of a Black man's mouth. Random side note, the Haitians in my group were like, y'all, do we think he's Haitian? They looked him up. He's Nigerian. So they feel like they're safe right now. It's like a new front in the diaspora wars. But anyway, I think it's really interesting to choose, to DeRay's point about who's going to be most impacted by this, a Black man to be the messenger of this for the state of Florida. And I do think that we are going to see the return of diseases and viruses that we had all but eradicated in the United States. And I do think that many of us are operating from a place of privilege in talking about what we want to or don't want to be vaccinated against. Like, there are so many other people in countries where these things continue to run rampant who know better and know the protection that vaccines can provide. And so I just think it's like further evidence of like the growing anti-scientific, movement in the United States gaining real traction. And it's sad because it's not an individual choice, right? Like, your decision to get vaccinated or not has an impact on the people around you. And it's just, I think, also rooted in America's rugged individualism. So
your comment around if he was Haitian or Nigerian reminded me of, we didn't talk about this, but Amanda Seales' Jubilee episode happened while we were going to, which was like, sent the internet on fire. And there was this part, maybe AJ, the producer, could like maybe splice in the part where she kind of talks about immigrants and stuff like that. But anywho, that's what that made me think of, is, and made me think of how we need more minds talking about why sometimes the Black immigrant community tends to drink raccoon soup so much, without it being xenophobic, and without it being a real thoughtful conversation about the realities that we're seeing. The other thing about this is like if enough families agree with something, it's not just families, it's culture. So when you go to certain places in Florida, when you go to certain places in Georgia, Mississippi, and stuff like that, yeah, it's not just one or two families. That is like the culture, Kentucky, Ohio. It's not just a couple of families. It's the culture of a place. And you see things like this be able to get life. And what to me is the evil genius of the right is that now you have more poor people who are going to die. So there's two options. You either have a booming big pharma and you now have all these people who are making those shareholders and big pharma happy, and you have people dying and giving up homes and more property that you can now flip and exploit. And you have a people willingly doing the genocide. And what's going on in Gaza and Israel, Israel has to drop the bombs on Gaza because those Palestinians want to live. Here, we say, you don't need to drop a bomb on us. We'll kill ourselves through these kind of cultural and political choices. And that, to me, is what's sad, is that there is this kind of, we talked about it the last time on the podcast, this kind of like suicidal, nihilistic choice that the American makes that to me feels just as philosophical and spiritual to me as it does like political.
I think the point about Big Pharma is really interesting, right? Because people have said, big pharma's profit motive is why many of them are choosing not to get vaccinated, right? But you're like, oh, baby, big pharma's going to get its money one way or another, right? So they have pointed to, you know, like the American, like, you know, RFK has been testifying in front of Congress right now. The point is to talk about, you know, a whole bunch of things that have happened under his tenure. And, you know, one of the things that keeps coming up is, you know, they're pushing the senators, the Democratic senators anyway, are pushing him on this like narrative that he's been pushing about American research and medical institutions being corrupt. And, you know, everybody is like, well, big pharma funds a lot of the research. And that's why all of this scientific research says that we need to have these vaccines, because then big pharma gets to turn a profit. But I think, Miles, to your point, big pharma is going to turn a profit whether you're well or not, right? Big pharma is going to turn a profit whether you get the vaccine or not. The question is, what costs are you going to pay to ensure big pharma's profit?
Yeah, when all those people get measles, big pharma is going to be fine.
Yes.
Very fine. And we talk about the left a lot here and like Democrats and left, like, et cetera, et cetera. But to me, the left has a better job at having maybe political ideas that exist in the digital and communicating those things. So I know that sometimes when it comes to electoral politics, that doesn't happen. But like, it's harder to trick somebody who is on the left. Not impossible, as you can see. Shout out to Taylor. But it's harder. You got to think more. With the right, they're lying to you. They're using Big Pharma. They're not naming it. It's Big Pharma, great name. They're using it, and they can call it Big Pharma while you are Big Pharma. RFK Jr., you are now Big Pharma. And they can say, just like America, just like Donald Trump. Like, he gets to say all these things about the swamp and all this other stuff. Meanwhile, you're in the Epstein files.
We didn't talk about this, and I didn't put this in the chat, so maybe you didn't see it. But did you see that the DOJ is considering banning trans people from owning guns?
Yes. Yes.
I'm like, what? They are going to wage this culture war until they cannot possibly do it anymore. Miles, no, you disagree? What was that face?
No. I don't disagree with anything that you said. I was just... My frustration is, my request would be, yeah, go ahead and ban trans people with guns today. If I elect you and you want my Democratic money and you, or excuse me, you want my, well, Kamala did get my money, but not my vote. But if you want to get my support, then I need for you to go ahead and say, we ban it, all white men to do it. Like, I want, of course, not that literal language, because that would be too divisive. But if that's the game they're playing, play heavy ball. They're literally saying, oh, you're trans, no guns. You need something that says, oh, you're predisposed to what we would call white malehood. Because that's one thing that trans shooter and the white men shooters have in common, is that they all were born into white malehood. So we should be able to diagnose that. We should be able to create policy that's just as confrontational as they do. And that's what kind of pisses me off, that they get to be so derogatory. And then when it's time for us, we have thoughts and prayers and maybe some soft policy. And I'm like, no, we're literally bringing knives to a gunfight, literally.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the very least, we should be able to say, if you hold white supremacist values and beliefs, right, you shouldn't be able to own a gun, because those are supposed to be beyond the pale in our current society and culture.
You know, I wanted extreme. If you ever watch Larry the Cable Guy.
Not Larry the Cable Guy, you psycho.
If you ever said, I'm a redneck woman, I ain't no high class broad, if you are... all of it.
You're going to get a lot of Black people caught up in that, especially if you add Reba in it, because, you know, Black people love them some Reba, honey.
Some Reba. Oh, my God. Reba.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
The older I get, the more I'm intentional about my body. I started going to the gym a couple years ago just because I needed to get my mind right. And one of the benefits of it is that I've figured out how to do with my body, how to get stronger, how to be more flexible, all those things. But I needed to figure out what I was putting into my body as well. The exercise wasn't enough. And I wasn't really thoughtful about it, what I was putting into my body. And then I came across Mosh Bars. And I'll tell you, when people say you are what you eat, they are true. And I didn't know anything about protein snacks, but Mosh Bars really are the best. Now, Mosh, which you might have heard about on Shark Tank, was founded by Maria Shriver and her son, Patrick Schwarzenegger, with the simple mission to create a conversation about brain health through food, education, and research. Maria's father suffered from Alzheimer's, and since then, she and Patrick have dedicated themselves to finding ways to help other families dealing with this debilitating disease. Mosh bars also taste great, and they come in 9 mouthwatering flavors, including 3 new plant-based flavors, chocolate chip cookie, hazelnut chocolate chip, and peanut chocolate chip. Now, I love Mosh bars because there are a lot of bars out there. These taste incredible. I'm a big fan of the chocolate chip cookie. That's my go-to. I also like the peanut chocolate chip, but I am like 10 toes down on the chocolate chip cookie. And they just have the ingredients that do good for your body. And that matters to me. And I needed to find a bar that just was good and did good. And I'll tell you, I have put this into my routine when I go to the gym if I need a snack in between exercises. Because sometimes you get a little hungry. I'm in the gym for like 45 minutes, an hour every day, just drinking water, not always enough. And Mosh bars are great. If you want to find ways to give back to others and fuel your body and your brain, Mosh bars are the perfect choice for you. Head to moshlife.com/PSTP to save 20% off plus free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack or the new plant-based trial pack. That's 20% off plus free shipping on either the bestsellers trial pack or the plant-based trial pack at moshlife.com/PSTP. Thank you, Mosh, for sponsoring the episode.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolette Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life, and it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a 5-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
Speaking of being invested in supporting and believing in white supremacist ideals, my news this week is from a Texas media outlet called The Barbed Wire, which was reporting on the former national chairman of the Proud Boys, who lives in North Texas and is currently serving as a court-appointed attorney for indigent, that's the legal term, as you know, clients in North Texas. So, you know, Jason Lee Van Dyke began to work as a court-appointed attorney in Ditton County, which is just north of Dallas, in 2024. And he has taken on a number of clients. 17 of the clients are white, 10 are black, 4 are Latino, and 1 is Asian. And, you know, Denton has, in addition to being the one-time national chairman of the Proud Boys, which I feel like should be disqualification enough, has said things publicly like, I don't waste my breath on niggers like you. I hang them. And when he has been challenged on some of those statements, he's like, I lost my temper. That wasn't me going around finding African-American people and calling them the N-word. I was provoked. And I guess if it works for Liam Neeson, it can also work for him. But anyway, I think it's really interesting and wanted to bring to the pod this story of this man who has a very public record of being a white supremacist, again, serving as the national chairman of the Proud Boys, who has a Proud Boys tattoo on his arm that is visible to his clients, right? And then he can say things like, my personal beliefs don't impact my work. And in fact, as part of this interview, he put one of his black employees on the phone to say, tell them. I don't hold it against my clients that they are people of color. I'm here to do a job. And we're all supposed to pretend that his quote unquote personal beliefs have no impact on his ability to be effective counsel for the people of color he's charged with representing in North Texas. So wanted to make sure that stuff like this was on people's radar and bring it to the pod.
The Atlantic wrote a story a month ago that was called Where Have the Proud Boys Gone? And his central thesis is that because all the things they cared about, Trump just did with the government, they have been left with, they are trying to find new ways to be racist because, you know, they hated immigrants, but now ICE is the largest funded law enforcement group in the country. So Proud Boys don't need to go harass people because now ICE is doing it. And apparently the January 6th fallout has splintered some of the white supremacist groups and they disagree about strategy about January 6th. But it's like, these people ain't gone nowhere. They are still here. They're just trying to find new ways to think about how to put white supremacist thoughts in systems. And I couldn't imagine getting a court-appointed attorney who was a Proud Boy. I think about our work in Cleveland with the jail. And we were in a meeting the other day because we're trying to build this literacy program. And we were talking about, like, how do you meaningfully participate in your own defense if you can't read?
Yeah.
You are hosed on the front end, you know, like, you got a bad thing. So when people in the movie see things like the lawyers as a guide of the legal system, you're like, yeah, some of them are more than a guide. They are your translator. You can't read the plea that, you know, like, the system is really worse than what people see. And, you know, the older I get, I think about the way that we represent the system on TV and the court-appointed attorneys are like these noble, overworked people until one of them is a white supremacist. So you're like, no, you set him up to take a 30-year plea deal when if he had gone to trial, he'd be home.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah, it's just a scary story, right? I think so many times we've talked about on the podcast, there is like a global conservative takeover. And I like this, like in air quotes, like this article because it shows like the intimate ways that it's showing up, like the domestic ways that it's showing up in our reality. But you know me, I always have to like zone out because white supremacist groups being integrated into American politics is a lot of things, but new ain't one of them. I don't know if y'all know, I used to go to Hiram High School. Hiram was the name of the Grand Wizard in Georgia. And, you know, the Grand Wizard's colors, purple and gold, which was also our school colors. And I remember us, like a wave of Black people finding that out in our sophomore, junior year. And that kind of just tickling something in my head where it's like, oh, white supremacist groups and people don't just disappear and go live in a cabin somewhere and go burn crosses. Like, they integrate themselves into society and we see the effects of that. So yeah, that's what makes this a little chilling for me. And I'm just gonna say it. I also just feel like I wish people were as alarmed about the white supremacist takeovers when there's liberal power. I wish that these kind of articles, these type of discussions, this type of panic and alarm was happening, even if there's neoliberal power, because white supremacists integrating themselves into our political realities is not new. And it's been a danger. And it makes me sad that it seems like when Trump is in office, then we could talk about all of it. Do y'all remember last Trump where like it was like good people on both sides and people were talking to white supremacists and stuff. And then that just died with Biden. And now we're here again.
I just listened to this podcast episode about the evolution of ICE. And so, you know, Miles, to your point about, you know, what is or is not different, you know, depending on who is at the helm, you know, thinking about how a lot of local law enforcement agencies no longer have the opportunity to opt out of sharing fingerprint data, right, with ICE because of a program that was actually expanded under President Obama, you know? And so they're talking to an immigration rights expert who's like, look, there is a through line with very little change between Clinton, Bush, Trump won and Obama. And in fact, the man who was the architect of the family separation policies at the border worked for Obama. You know what I mean? Like, that's how he first got into the job. And so it's just, it's an interesting thing because I, you know, the folks I know who have worked on immigration and immigration reform have been saying this for a long time. And I think for, you know, my own learning in public and owning my own shit, I have been really resistant to narratives that are like on any issue, both parties are anywhere near each other. And I think the older I get, the more experience I have, and particularly the last, you know, two presidential administrations, I'm just like, damn, y'all might have been right.
Before we go to your news, Miles, which will be culture news, I wanted to talk about something that is breaking while we're recording. I forgot to pull up that clip on Joe Rogan where they just blatantly lie about trans school shooters.
Wonder if any of the woke AI chatbots have talked to any of these trans school shooters.
They might have.
You know what I'm saying?
Like, well, the last one, yeah, I don't know.
Bro, it's like seven of the last X amount of trans, seven in a row have been trans, except one was non-binary, which is just diet trans.
It is.
Right? That's diet trans. That's trans without the sugar.
I just don't get it. Like, I felt suicidal. Like, stay at home and kill yourself. Like, don't go into schools. Yeah,
or just go for a walk.
Yeah, that would be good, too.
You know,
yeah.
The problem is some people get to a certain point in their life and they have no friends and no community and no identity and no life. And it's not, they're not successful and they feel like shit. And then they have gender dysphoria on top of that. And then they're probably on a bunch of SSRIs. Which RFK yep. Jr. is going to apparently do some sort of a large scale research into the connection between mass shootings and psychiatric drugs, because it is real and everyone knows it. And it's just this dirty secret that no one talks about because all the media is paid off by the pharmaceutical drug companies yep. and nobody wants to make this correlation connection because you also risk the wrath of all these people that are on them saying, I'm on them and I'm not doing anything. It's not the pills. I need these to function. Maybe you do. I don't know. I don't know how your brain works. But the reality is most of these people that have committed mass murder are on psychiatric medication.
If you actually care about the identity of school shooters, it is white men. That is who is shooting up schools. That is the 99% of the demographic. That, and it has been true for as long as there have been school shootings. But I want to see what y'all thought about the clip with Joe Rogan. I was shocked, actually. I was like, wow, this is really gross.
I mean, it doesn't have to be rooted in any reality. I think we're seeing that, right? Like what gets said often on podcasts and what people pick up and what becomes the soundbite and what gets circulated becomes the truth. And it's similar to like a newspaper retraction, right? Like any attempt at inserting fact, any attempt at like retracting it later gets missed, it gets overlooked. And I think this is really dangerous rhetoric. I think the bathroom stuff and the sports stuff didn't stick in making trans people cultural boogeymen. And this is the next place where they are going. It's disgusting and it's terrifying, but I actually think that this will become, like, I can picture the graphic that gets shared on Instagram as a result of this soundbite, you know?
Yeah. So one of the biggest flaws to me about the left's communication skills in 2025 is that they think it needs to be based on fact. I'm sorry. Like, I think that we're in a space where the right is out storytelling, if that's how you want to phrase it, but also out myth-making. And we see that whoever has the most fascinating myth wins, and we see that being weaponized. So I think one of the reasons why that didn't necessarily surprise me or make me feel any type of way is because that is the ball game that we're playing. That is the ball game that we're playing. How do you take something that's happening into the news and bend it and morph it and mutate it to serve your political interests? And they know how to do that casually, and they know how to do it by just speaking about what they want to be true. So they just want that to be the true story. They want the idea that transness is some type of psychosis, and this fits perfectly in that narrative. My big thing is, why are we so, why is the left so absent of narratives and myths? Specifically, when one of your opponents is white people and white men. It shouldn't be hard to make them seem like the boogeyman because they've been the boogeyman. And that to me is what's annoying, is to feel like we're always being outpaced because we're playing by the rules.
The other thing I want to talk about before we go to Miles to close us out was Zohran. So I don't know if you all saw, but Eric Adams is being recruited by the Trump administration to get a senior job as the ambassador to Saudi Arabia, I believe. So that he does not run to be mayor and that they can clear the field so that it's just a one-to-one with Cuomo and Zohran. Their desperation to try and get Zohran out of here should turn all of us into campaign field workers for Zohran Mamdani. I might actually go out this weekend if they are doing door knocking just because this is absurd. The lengths that they're going through to try and stop him from being the mayor.
Yeah, who was the... There was another man who was running. Sorry, it was a pretty crowded field. He was like, you know, never going to make the cut. But he's the one that Bobby Shmurda supposedly endorsed, which is how he ended up on my radar. Miles, I know that's a wild face, but it actually happened. And he dropped out and said... something similar, basically, was like, look, I wasn't going to win. What was going to happen was we were going to split the vote and we were going to find that Zohran was going to win. And that's the worst possible thing for New York City. And so I'm calling on all of the other candidates who claim to care about the city and its future to also drop out and let it be a like one-to-one. But I mean, yes, we should talk about Zohran, but we should also talk about the fact that people think that Andrew Cuomo is the answer. Like, to Miles's point about like establishment Democrats having any imagination, like, I don't know how many times voters have to tell you they are not interested in Cuomo. And y'all just keep trying it, right? But I think they're just so convinced that people will be so fearful of this brown man with this weird ancestry that no one can make sense of, right? That they will run into Cuomo's arms. And to DeRay's point, I hope New Yorkers prove them wrong. And I hope they prove them wrong decisively.
I love this moment. And like months ago, I remember saying, like, when I was kind of saying on this podcast that I think AOC should break, like, even if it's an invented break, right? I already told you I'm okay with myth making and lying, right? When it comes to politics. So even if you have to invent a publicity moment to make it appear as if you broke, there are people in the Democratic Party. I was thinking about AOC. I was thinking about Bernie Sanders. Of course, thinking about Zohran, who should break with the Democratic Party, if just symbolically, because the brand is so toxic. And I think that this moment to me is great because it shows the actual division. So we've been underneath this guise of Republican versus Democrat for my whole life, and now we're not underneath that anymore. In the side of a Democratic Party, there's still more splits to be had, and now we're seeing who really is for you as a person and as an American citizen and who's not. And I think that's been really illuminating because, to your point, Sharonda, it was been hard for so many people to wake up to the fact that we're not getting what we deserve from our representation as folks on the left, progressive leftists, liberals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're not getting it. And I think moments like this show that, oh, it is corporatism versus roots. And here it is. And not in a way that, to me, in my opinion, was just the veneer of Obama. it's coming in a way that actually might make people's life materially better in a way that's like significant to them that they will remember. So I'm actually kind of excited about it because it's not working. He's eating them up. Did you see that meme about the about somebody like sent him a picture of frying pork, and he was like, Habibi, Muslims are not vampires and this is not garlic. Like, like, what did you think? Like, he's cannibalizing, and I mean that in a good way. Like, he's cannibalizing all of this fascist hatred into this, like, social media irreverence, and it's really masterful, but it's also based in the fact that he doesn't seem like a freaking scumbag, that he doesn't seem like somebody who you wouldn't trust, Hakeem, et cetera, et cetera. These people who you're like, you're not sitting right in my spirit, you know? So I'm kind of happy about this division.
I'm ready for Eric Adams to go do something, not be ambassador or anything, but just to go sit down somewhere so I can just laugh at his tweets.
Oh, the thing is, Eric is not going nowhere. And I think he's going to be so useful to the right if he gets totally shunned by the left. So he's going to be so useful. Yeah. So I just don't see him going anywhere. And he does have some support. So it's not like he doesn't have any support. And I was even thinking about it in the dark crevices of my mind around how Trump got to be president and how what we're seeing in the atmosphere of the digital right is a whole bunch of possible Trumps. You know, I'm always talking about in 20 years, in 30 years, I'm like, a buffoon from the 80s is a president in the 2000s. Do you know how many buffoons from 2025 are going to be presidents in 2045?
Yeah.
Yes, unfortunately, I don't think it's that easy to get the right out of here, but I think it's that easy to get people who serve the right out of left politics.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
Pod Save the People is brought to you by Fast Growing Trees. Fall is planting season. And did you know that many plants and trees actually do better when they're planted this time of year? But you have to know where to start. And that's why I love fastgrowingtrees.com. Doesn't matter if you live in the sunny South or if the air is getting chilly where you are, the plant experts at fastgrowingtrees.com can help you find the perfect fit for your place. Now, they actually have everything you need for your yard, for your garden, whatever you need. It's fruit trees, privacy trees, flowering trees, shrubs. They really do have it all. And I know nothing about trees, but that's what's great because they have the plant experts who can help you figure out the best thing for where you are and what you're trying to do. And all the plants and trees are locally grown in the U.S. to ensure that they will actually thrive in your yard. This has been a game changer for some of my best friends. One of my friends who just bought a beautiful house in Brooklyn and needed some plants, my sister, because you don't have to be an expert to get it. Myself, I'm a simple plant guy, so I use it to just have some stuff around the house. But my friends who have big yards, this is like great because they don't have to do the guessing game anymore. Big yard, small yard, no yard, over 6,000 plants to fit in any space, from indoor plants to fruit trees, full-size privacy. I mean, it really is everything. And their 14-point quality checklist ensures that you're getting the best quality plants possible. And each plant is cared for individually based on its needs, from watering routines to amount of sunlight, to make sure that you give the plants the care that they need to thrive. Do you have questions about soil type, landscape design, how to take care of your plants? That's why they have the plant experts. This fall, they have the best deals for your yard, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get 15% off their first purchase when using the code PSTP at checkout. That's 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code PSTP at checkout. Now's the perfect time to plant. Use PSTP to save today. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Check out the link below or in the show notes and support the show.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolette Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life, and it is all happening right now. Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a five-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst of the worst. Then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
So, I don't cook soul food every single day because I read the news and my blood pressure is great. My sugar levels are great. But today, this week is Yemaya. On Saturday, Orisha named Yemaya. It's her day on Saturday. It's the blood moon. It's a harvest. So I make a pot of collard greens during significant moments. And when I was figuring out, I don't know, I was just kind of curious about Black culinary expressions. And I came across this article that I wanted to share with you all because it's actually an anniversary of sorts. So I'm going to read a little bit from this article from Southern Living. I feel so suburban reading an article from Southern Living. So Nina Williams Mbengue was just 12 years old when she began typing the manuscript for what would become The Taste of Country Cooking for her aunt, Edna Lewis. She carefully transcribed Lewis's handwritten notes on yellow legal pads, and some passages, almost 50 years later, are still committed to her memory. She didn't know that Aunt Edna's book would become the beloved classic it has in the years since, credited with inspiring the modern farm-to-table movement. The 1976 Southern Cookbook also documented the foodways of Freetown, Virginia, an African-American community founded in 1866 by formerly enslaved people, including Lewis's grandfather. So one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this to the podcast is, A, it's good news. And I wanted to bring and insert a little bit of joy into people's listening experience, into my fellow co-hosts, but also because I think recipes and cooking are so foundational to memory and ancestral reverence, specifically when it comes to Black people. And there's been a particular type of shame that has happened around Black people because Black people are often in food deserts, and we often have these kind of dietary or produced ailments that happen to us. And often it gets blamed on our soul food. It gets blamed on our Southern food. And not only are there ways to engage with Black cooking and culinary that is healthy, a lot of our recipes are already healthy, and also it's been foundational for white folks. So when you see so many white influencers who have their farms and they're making certain dishes, these too are Black American traditions. So A, I wanted to shout out Edna Lewis and this beautiful book's 50th anniversary because I think more people should engage with things that we just see as farm to table or holistic eating, that there are also ways that Black people kind of figured out how to navigate this culinary world. And it also, to me, did a work in not demonizing the things that are a part of my ancestry because the media fed me that narrative. Now, of course, I do not cook with the pork shoulder every day or week, but there are other ways to engage with Black food that is just as powerful. And it's not our food that is killing us. It is the lack of everything else that's killing us, which took me a while, I'll say, as an individual who struggled with my body and food and stuff, to really understand. I'm like, oh, wow. Even as I'm on my fitness journey now, I'm eating more Black soul food than I've ever have, which is, to me, opposite, but here I am. So I just wanted to spread that, wondering if you ever heard of Edna Lewis, wondering what your relationship with food is. I know that DeRay makes a fantastic PB&J and fried salmon.
Shout out to the air fryer.
And dry salmon.
I said fry.
Oh, fried right. Salmon.
Fried
okay.
Salmon. But yeah, so I'm interested in all you all's interactions with Black culinary.
Yeah, I had not heard of Edna Lewis, so thank you for putting this on our radar. Tony Tipton Martin, who wrote the foreword for the re-released edition, is someone I do know. And in fact, I own Jubilee and I own her cocktail book. And I actually read them as history books because they're just so fascinating in talking about Black food pioneers and Black cultural traditions and what she calls food pathways, but also are about like migratory patterns of people, right? Like where we went, the things we brought with us, that sort of stuff. you know, I was raised by my grandparents, both of whom migrated to California in the 40s and 50s from South Louisiana. And actually, for most of my childhood, grew most of our vegetables. We had a walnut tree. We had an avocado tree. My grandmother grew what in New Orleans they call melaton. In other Spanish-speaking places, they call it chayote. Like we had strawberries, we had tomatoes, we had string beans. And so I remember the first time I had a canned string bean, I was like, what is this that y'all have been eating? No wonder y'all don't like vegetables. This is terrible. The first time I had Jack in the Box, actually, which is a pretty big food chain here in Southern California, I was an 11th grader, right? And so, like, wow. To your point, like, a lot of what my grandparents cooked, it was like, go out there, get this, and then, like, I mean, my grandmother fried chicken, fried catfish. She did all the things, right? But a lot of it was also just like sourced differently, right? Which I think is also a big thing. I have been really pleased to see in some of the like wellness and dietary spaces, people talking about how much wellness and diet conversation excludes quote unquote ethnic foods, right? Even as we see people who live in many other places eat those same quote unquote ethnic foods and not have the same, to your point, health complications that we do. And so I think there's a movement to say, how do you reclaim your cultural foods while also being well? And then like the things that we have come to think of as like American or Southern, many of them were recipes developed by enslaved people who were enjoyed, you know, by the people who were enslaving them and became in some instances like fine dining, right? And so I think there's a little bit of, to your point, wanting to take pride in some of that culinary legacy, right? To say a lot of what y'all think of as just American food is Black food, right? Is Black American food, Black Southern food in particular, because I also think there's always an attempt at erasing the South and the South's contributions to culture. So really excited for this and excited to try some of your collard greens next time we're in the same place.
Okay.
So I don't know much about making food, but what this made me think of is back to Miles' earlier point about the power of mythology, that we are often up against a deep-seated racist mythology that has shaped people's understanding of what is up and down, what is true, what is left and right. And it becomes so deep-seated that people don't even interrogate it anymore. So like the, you know, who created this, or is this healthy or not, or what health means, or da-da. Like all of those things are rarely, some of them are not rooted in fact, but they are rooted in the mythology that becomes so persistent that people experience it as fact. And I think about what does it mean to retell, you know, even like the movie Soul Food and, you know, like what that did to people around healthy food and diabetes and da-da-da. And I'm like, you know, the more I've learned, I'm like, you know, glaucoma is a, you know, you gonna die, you gonna go blind if you ain't got an eye doctor. That's not you being lazy. You know, you can't get to an eye doctor, you ain't got it. Or like the high blood pressure stuff, can you even get, I think about growing up and I'm like, my grandmother could not easily get to a doctor. So it actually didn't matter what she ate or didn't eat. She could getting a doctor's appointment back then was so hard that like it wasn't a matter of her willingness, which is what people have been talking about. So that's my takeaway from the end of this episode is I'm like, oh, let me think about the myth making that we engage in that is productive, that is generative, that reshapes people's sense of possibility. And one way I think about myth making is like, what is the story that we tell about a reality that's just not here yet, but we know it's possible? Like how do we tell that story really strong?
Can I say one other thing about cooking, though? Sorry. And that is, I think often when we talk about cooking, we talk about our grandmothers. I want to give a shout out to my grandfather, who was also a fantastic cook.
Okay.
And when my grandmother died 2 weeks before I started high school, fed a household of 3 children on a full-time basis, fed our cousins, fed our friends, and did not think that labor in the kitchen was beneath him. So shout out to my grandfather being an example of a man stepping up and doing what is traditionally considered women's work and doing it well and from a place of love. So shout out, Grandpa.
My grandfather can make some great cream of wheat, baby. Grandpa, now that cream of wheat was top tier. I'm sure he made other things, but all I remember is the cream of wheat. Grandpa in the morning, he couldn't compete with my great grandmother and my grandmother. Like they just wouldn't let him, like no matter what he wanted to do, they just said the kitchen is
mine. It just wasn't going to happen.
But breakfast, they didn't fight him on breakfast. And baby, cream of wheat, that old school cream of wheat on the stove. You know what I mean?
What an act of love. What I mean, sir, he probably wanted to love you in that way, you know?
It was great. Grandpa was on it.
Yeah.
One thing about DeRay is he's gonna champion a carb. every single time. But that makes me want to my boyfriend's father, since we moved, he's cooked for us, like when you talk about pork chops, soul food, and to your point, it's been so cool to he's a pastor and we're a gay couple, a queer couple, a diet trans couple to some, and like so like he just us him making this soul food and us having conversations and us all being assigned male at birth and just having certain things of being seen as Black men that we could talk about over soul food has been really healing. And to your point, I think I love that. These kind of culinary expressions are too often gendered and they shouldn't be because they're beautiful for everybody.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothes.
Dan is very busy, clothes only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.